Marketplace is supported by Epson, workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology, workforce printers for home offices, small offices, and network work groups, Epson.com.
Drones, cyber bank robbers, welcome to the future. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. And by Insightly Customer Relationship Management. Insightly is designed to help small businesses manage contacts, projects, and sales with ease. More information at insightly.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen.
In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday the 16th. It's President's Day. Thanks so much for being with us. Maybe I've watched too many movies, but it's not hard for me to imagine a sky full of drones zipping around overhead, running errands, dropping packages. But it turns out the FAA has nixed that vision, at least for now. The agency has proposed new rules for commercial drones, including that operators need to be able to see their drone at all times. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports.
The FAA's proposed new rules apply to drones used for commercial purposes. Anyone of legal age will be able to take a test to get permission to fly one, as long as it's below 500 feet. And you can do a lot with those rules, says Ryan Kalo of the University of Washington, who specializes in robotics law.
You could make sure that your crops are healthy if you're a farmer, cover a breaking news event, you could film a movie.
And Tim McLean, who runs a drone research program at Brigham Young University, says his team will benefit too.
Under the current rules, it's just very difficult for us to test. We have to go to restricted airspace, military installations.
The FAA is proposing some important limits, though. You can't fly over populated areas, and an operator has to always be able to see the drone.
That's no better than just doing it as a hobby.
Adam Tier researches technology policy at George Mason University. He says the proposed rules would limit a whole host of applications, from monitoring pipelines over long distances to, yes, delivering Amazon orders. Tier says the FAA is taking a better safe than sorry approach.
Which is completely understandable since the FAA is under a mandate to keep the nation's airspace safe for aircraft operation.
After all, the commercial drones could weigh as much as 55 pounds and fly as fast as 100 miles per hour. Still, Amazon, for one, isn't amused. It put out a terse statement suggesting that if the FAA isn't more flexible, it could take its proposed drone delivery program elsewhere, to other countries. In New York, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Bank robbers have pulled off one of the largest heists ever. And their weapon of choice is computers. An international group of hackers has allegedly stolen more than $1 billion from banks around the world. We got whiffs of the story over the weekend. Today, we got a full report on the hack from this cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Labs. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports the theft went on for months before anyone realized it was happening.
In terms of robberies, this was no smash and grab. Instead, the hackers used elaborate phishing schemes to impersonate bank employees, delivering malware through attachments which then lay dormant for months, gathering key information.
These guys were clearly a sizable group with a variety of different areas of expertise.
Chris Doggett is the managing director of Kaspersky North America, the firm hired to investigate the hack. He says the thieves used the info to transfer money to fake accounts or actually dispense cash through ATMs.
They staged a very well-planned attack. They really took their time to get to know each and every one of their targets before they went about trying to take the money out of the system.
Doggett says Kaspersky can't disclose which banks were hit, but that hackers typically limited themselves to $10 million before moving on to the next bank.
This is just a new frontier. It's a constant game of cat and mouse.
Stephen Pau is general manager of security at Barracuda Networks. He says cybercrime directed at banks isn't likely to stop anytime soon, but tougher security measures could make the economics unworkable, just like, say, stealing car stereos.
And it isn't because you still can't break windows and you still can't cut metal. It just becomes more and more expensive to actually go obtain the stereo that maybe what is worth on the black market.
Thus far, no banks have acknowledged the theft. At a White House summit on cybersecurity last week, President Obama called for a new law requiring public disclosure in all cases of compromised personal and financial data. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed today, but we'll see how markets in the rest of the world did when we do the numbers. Like pretty much everything is made in China these days. iPhones and Barbie dolls, shoes and zippers, and all that making and selling has created big cash reserves for Chinese companies. Of course, we know where there's cash, there are people looking to invest it. WNYC's Isla Meritz takes a look at the growing market among Chinese investors for U.S. real estate.
This is the Osten. It's a $250 million condominium building now under construction on the Brooklyn waterfront. It covers a whole city block. The name Osten means east in Dutch, but the builder, Xinyuan, is Chinese. I got a tour from Robert Seta.
I'm one of the least important site supervisors, but I do know the whole thing. Please watch ahead.
When it's done, the building will include a lap pool, a daycare center, and landscaped roof decks. From the fourth floor, there are killer views of the Manhattan skyline.
This is the highest floor we can go on at this moment. Oh, wow. He's pouring about 14,000 square feet of concrete today.
And there are three more stories yet to be built. It'll be close to a year before this building is finished, but people are already buying apartments. Many of them, like Wenzhou Xia, are Chinese living in China. Xia is a mining executive in Hong Kong.
It's a one-bedroom I'm considering right now. It's 740 square feet.
Xia recently took time out from a business trip to ink the deal. He told me this idea of purchasing property that is literally on the other side of the globe, well, it may seem far-fetched to Americans, but among high-earning Chinese, foreign property is considered to be one part of a balanced portfolio.
So this is like, you know, a small piece of diversification for us, right?
To be clear, Xia has no plans to live in this apartment. He expects to collect a $3,000 rent check every month.
I think that's going to be able to most likely cover my mortgage after the initial down payment. There shouldn't be any cash outlay from me.
And in a few years, when he wants to sell, he's confident he'll make a tidy profit. China watchers say these may just be the first drops in a heavy rain of Chinese money that's beginning to fall on big world cities like New York. Here's China's leader, Xi Jinping, addressing world leaders and CEOs at a summit last November. Joel Rothstein listened closely. He's with the international law firm Paul Hastings, working on big deals between Western and Chinese companies.
He basically pointed out that over the next 10 years, the amount of outbound investment from China to the world is going to be over $1.25 trillion.
Here's why. For years, China had strict capital controls, meaning it was difficult to get legal clearance to move money out of the country. But in 2013 and 2014, Beijing loosened those rules. So now?
We're basically at a place now in the market that anytime there's a major prime asset that's going to go up for sale in New York and London or Paris,
it's going to be shown to investors in China.
So that means that there's this whole group of new competitors and also potential purchasers for real estates around the globe.
Last October, Hilton Hotels agreed to sell the Waldorf Astoria for almost $2 billion to a company with no history in New York, China's Anbang Insurance. Across the river in Brooklyn, the Osten is thought to be the first major construction project by a Chinese company without a local partner. It's unlikely to be the last. Xinyuan says it's actively scouting new opportunities to develop property in America. In New York, I'm Ilya Meritz for Marketplace.
Right at this moment, I'm wearing shoes that were made in China. I checked before. before the show. No real surprise there, I guess. By some accounts, 98% of the shoes sold in the U.S. were made overseas. Zuzi, then, is part of the 2%. It's a family shoe company here in Los Angeles run by Ryan Campbell and her sister Alex and their mother Nikki. They make shoes for women and kids in a 4,000-square-foot studio in downtown L.A. I recently took a tour of their manufacturing space and asked Ryan why they decided to make shoes here.
It was so interesting to me because I didn't realize through school that there was any other type of manufacturing than overseas and mass production. And so it kind of woke me up to the idea that this was possible in the U.S. And we thought it would be a lot easier than it was. And then once we realized there weren't any factories that did production for other brands, we knew if we're going to do this in the U.S., we got to do it ourselves.
Can you guys just show me step by step how a shoe gets made?
Yeah, sure. So our leather is all Italian tanned that we import and tan.
Wow, it's really soft.
Yes, thank you. Also, we do all of our own custom printing in Los Angeles.
So we're looking here at some leather with stripes and polka dots and squares, and so you're printing directly onto the leather.
Mm-hmm. And it's a process that we've imported to do here in the United States, but typically this is done in Italy or France at the footwear factories overseas.
And the shoes, they're all basically the same design, is that right?
They are. We currently have one style.
So how many pieces go into a shoe?
Well, that's what we think makes our production special. We only use currently 5 pieces, but it's what allows us to make our shoes in the U.S.
So I was surprised. I mean, it's the women's shoe is in the $90 range.
Mm-hmm.
Other shoes I know of made in the U.S., made in California, are in the $300 range.
Yeah.
Why that price point? Why that $90 price point on your shoes?
You know, to a lot, it's not an affordable price point, but to us, we feel like it's a very fair price point for goods that are made in the U.S. And we structured our manufacturing in a way that we could offer that. And we don't use sales reps and traditional advertising. I think that's something we've decided to abandon. And we rely on, you know, Instagram and Facebook and our customers and their experience with the product and word of mouth to get our brand out there.
So can you show me? So we've cut out our 5 pieces, and now where do we go?
We take it over to my sister's station, and she does all of the eyeleting and all of the finishing, marking, and numbering the sizes. Because we do only use 5 pieces, it cuts down all of the extra labor and materials needed to get a shoe, but allowed us to have a more simple design, which is, you know, probably the most important aspect of our shoe is the design and the quality of the shoe itself.
All right, so we've put our eyelets in, and then we go over here?
Uh-huh.
And this is my station.
This is your station.
So the parts come to me prepared to be assembled. This is our back tab being sewn on right now.
So how many shoes do you sew together in a day?
We can do up to 50 a day. And we're trying
50 pairs?
50 pair. And we're trying to push our production to around 100 pair by the end of the year.
So you're going to have to hire more people to double your production, but where do you find cobblers these days?
If they exist, they're usually employed by someone. So we're really struggling to try to locate them, and we hope to soon. But it's a dying trade. And I think back in 1940, there were like 250,000 shoemaking jobs. There's 14,000 today. So it's a rare person to find. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's, you know, there's not a machine doing all of the work. We can get a machine to apply the glue, but the actual putting together of the shoe take some skill to do.
How many hours a day do you guys actually spend making shoes?
About 16.
Seven days a week?
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth it? Are there ever days where you're like, wow, I want a 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week job. This is crazy time?
I would say I was more tired and more overworked working for someone else than I am here. And I'm inspired to keep doing it because I know it's for us and it's a business that we will get to grow and continue working at. But we get tired.
Well, thank you all so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Alex, Ryan, and Nikki Campbell at their studios here in Los Angeles. And we've got a video tour of Zuzi on our website, marketplace.org. Thank you. But first, let's do the numbers.
13, as we know, is a very unlucky number throughout the world, and that resonance has been curious to me.
No, not those numbers, our numbers. Here we go. U.S. markets are closed for President's Day today. In Europe, markets slipped off seven-year highs as Eurozone finance ministers began and stopped negotiations on continuing Greece's economic support. Okay, actually, Greece stopped the negotiations when it refused to accept an extension of the current bailout terms, which expire this month. Greeks say the bailout's austerity measures squeeze them too hard. Britain's FTSE slipped 0.25%. In Germany, the DAX slid 0.33%. In Japan, the Nikkei added 0.5% after the government said gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 2.2% last quarter. The increase was fueled by a jump in exports, helped by the yen getting cheaper against the dollar. Bond markets were closed today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. The markets may be uncertain, but institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price's disciplined investment approach to help reach their long-term investment goals. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. And by Epson. Epson Robotics Solutions are designed to help manufacturers succeed. With high-precision industrial robots installed in factories throughout the world, designed to improve product quality and increase yields. Where there's business, there's Epson. Conversations from the Corner Office is supported by Nuance Power PDF, designed to easily and accurately convert, edit, combine, and collaborate on business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. How's the burger market doing? We'll get a taste when Jack in the Box reports earnings. We'll find out who's top dog when the Westminster Kennel Club announces Best in Show in Madison Square Garden. And 49 years ago tomorrow, Beach Boy Brian Wilson started work on his theremin-heavy song, Good Vibrations. I'm Robert Garoba.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrian Hill. Egypt is carrying out airstrikes against ISIS training camps in Libya. The jets they're using are reportedly F-16 fighters. Like much of that country's air power, they're American-made. But officials in Cairo have just formalized a deal to buy 24 fighter jets from France, which means Egypt is diversifying who it buys military supplies from. Marketplace's Noelle King reports on why now.
It could be that by buying French jets, Egypt is sending the U.S. a message. Robert Springborg is a professor of war studies at King's College London.
It's an attempt by President Sisi to tell the United States that, well, if you try to use the tap of arms supplies, turning it off and on to affect our foreign policy behavior, then we can go elsewhere.
The U.S. suspended some military aid to Egypt in 2013 to pressure the military regime to restore democracy. Sim Tak, a military analyst with Stratfor, thinks the U.S. is probably most worried about the economic implications of Egypt's French purchase. What military aid means is that Washington gives Egypt $1 billion+ a year to buy stuff that's made in the U.S.
If Egypt starts buying from other sources, obviously that removes some of the funding that can go back to U.S. companies.
Amy Hawthorne, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, thinks this is a story about French economics. France has been trying and failing to sell the Rafale jet, the model Egypt bought, and it was a $5.9 billion sale.
France's economy is in really tough shape, as we know. The defense industry in France has traditionally been very important to its economy, and so I think this is a very important sale for the French economy.
So important, she says, that France gave Egypt a really good deal. Hawthorne says the terms of the agreement suggest that if Egypt should default on the loan for the weapons, the French government will cover the cost. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
Emoji users out there likely sent a lot of hearts this weekend, and a lot of kissy face emoji, probably a whole lot of kissy face emoji. But what about when the message you want to send is a little less kissy, and maybe more obscure? Have you ever wondered why you have the emoji choices you do? We asked journalist Hannah Rosefield to help answer our question. She's written a lot about emoji. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
So when I go to my phone and I'm texting and I wanted to put an emoji in, I have a limited range of emoji I can use. Where does that set of emoji come from?
There's a company called the Unicode Consortium, and Unicode provides a unique code for every character that appears, whether that's a number, a letter, or something like an emoji character. And that means that you can send these characters between different platforms, so from an iPhone to an Android phone, and be sure that it will appear clearly and correctly. So it differs a little depending on what device you're using.
And so what are some of those differences? If I'm texting you from my Android to your iPhone, what might appear differently?
All kinds of things. So Unicode provides a code for every emoji and then a descriptor. But how the different platforms interpret that descriptor, how they choose to represent it, is very much up to them. So iPhone have chosen to represent most of the people as female, whereas Android represent a lot of them as male. So if I have an iPhone and I send the picture of the Unicode calls it a dancer to my friend who has an Android, I will see a woman in a red dress, and the Android user used to receive a man in a suit, dancing. But now Android has actually changed it so that their figures are no longer identifiable by gender or by race. So now it's just a little yellow person clutching a rose in its teeth.
Now, another difference I noticed is if I send a fairly chaste kiss from an iPhone to an Android user, it becomes a very passionate kiss.
Right. And that is one of the problems, is Unicode is designed to standardize the way that characters appear, but actually it's doing that in quite a limited way. You can send something that has a very different emotional content, even though if you described it in language, it might be the same thing.
And right now, all the emoji we have are either that cartoon Simpson yellow color or they're Caucasian, right?
That's right, with a couple of exceptions. That's certainly how it appears on iPhone.
Why is that the case?
No one has really explained why that is the case. I think it is simply that Unicode said to iPhone and Android and all the other platforms, this is the name of each character, go and design it as you would like. And the way they designed it was white.
Now, Unicode is in the process of diversifying these emoji, right?
That's right. Over the past couple of years, there have been a lot of calls for emoji to diversify. And at first, those calls were directed to Apple, who then said, we actually can't do anything about this by ourselves because it all goes through Unicode. And since then, Unicode's been in consultation with Apple. And in November, Unicode released a report saying that with the next update, which should come in the middle of this year, you will be able to set one of 5 skin tones for your emoji.
What's the discussion around this move?
People are happy about it. They've recognized that it's a problem. They're glad that Unicode and Apple and Android are doing something about it. There are some reservations. So some people have said that actually making it so that everything can be divided into one of 5 racial categories is not the most sensitive way of doing it. Other people have suggested that it might be better if they removed race entirely by making all the emoji yellow. And actually, that is what Android have decided to do. It will definitely be an improvement on the current situation. Whether it's perfect, probably not.
And if you could choose one emoji to add to the list of emoji that are out there, what would you choose?
Oh, that's an easy question. I would choose crossed fingers emoji because there isn't really a way to say, I hope so. And some people have suggested using the 4-leaf clover, but good luck actually isn't interchangeable with I hope so. So I think that's really something that needs to be brought in.
Hannah Rosefield is a freelance journalist. Thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
When we we talk about numbers on Marketplace, we're usually thinking about them in terms of the market. You know, da-da-da-da-da. They don't let me sing much around here. But numbers can have a whole other meaning, depending on where you're from. They can be lucky, like the number 7, or maybe just a number you like. I'm easily amused by palindromic primes, which is just hard to explain. Numbers can be symbolic, like Sweet 16. Rogerson's Book of Numbers is a book all about these numerical meanings. Barnaby Rogerson reflects on the numbers we use every day.
13.
I was brought up for 2 years in Virginia. And it's always obsessed me that there were 13 states that rebelled against Britain, quite rightly, and also 13 states in the Confederacy that rebelled against the Union. And 13, as we know, is a very unpropitious, unlucky number throughout the world, and that resonance has been curious to me.
3.
My father-in-law was a banker who's been watching the markets all his life, now over 80. And he always told me that 3% was the magical era of growth, both as a farmer and as a business. And his job as a banker was to find out how people were getting more than 3% and how long they could sustain it before they were found out.
0.
I don't really like 0 because you can't list zeros. And you can't even list, nothingnesses because you've got to the end of it. And it's also fascinating to find out how late the concept of 0 got to the British Isles, not to the 16th century.
42.
I love 42, both because of the bizarreness of the, exploration of the universe. Douglas Adams, when the computer that knows everything in the world is asked to give the answer, and it's just the number 42.
One final note before we go today, it's President's Day, and it's a day and a weekend when car dealers sell a whole lot of cars. But long before minivans were decked in red, white, and blue balloons, before TV ads featured one car special after another, President's Day was all about bicycles. According to The Atlantic, in the late 1800s, Washington's birthday was celebrated with two wheels, bicycle races, bicycle sales. It was the day the newest models of bicycles were unveiled. Which means we've been buying these symbols of personal freedom for a very long time. That'll do it for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Invest Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, a European location offering a skilled, loyal, agile workforce at the ready. More at investni.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. And by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times. Prepare to read beyond the expected.
And that's it. That's our show today. The markets were closed, but they'll be open again tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrian Hill. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.